Today on the 21st Show, Alden Global Capital has become one of America's largest newspaper owners. And as the company devoured paper after paper, it hit on a formula for making money.
The first thing they would do is sell the building. The second thing they would do is trim the staff, often by 30, 40, and sometimes 50%.
That's documentary filmmaker Rick Goldsmith, who takes a deep dive into these acts of creative destruction in his latest work, Stripped for Parts: American Journalism on the Brink. Goldsmith is in Central Illinois to present a screening of his film tonight. I'm Brian Mackey with Rick Goldsmith for the hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we're talking about the crisis in local journalism and its implications for democracy. My guest is Rick Goldsmith, an Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker. His latest film is Stripped for Parts: American Journalism on the Brink. It examines how hedge funds and private equity firms are hollowing out America's newspapers. Let's listen to the trailer.
Tomorrow will be the final edition of the Rocky Mountain News.
The last decade and a half, we've seen 1,800 newspapers disappear.
The Denver Post isn't dying. The Denver Post is being murdered.
The media is a food chain which would fall apart without local newspapers.
We've been hearing for the last decade or so that newspapers are dying, they're dinosaurs. Because of the internet, there's this bigger problem. There's an industry that's out to destroy newspapers and doing it deliberately.
Distressed investing is called vulture investing for a reason. They're feeding on a carcass of a company. They want to get in, make some money, and get out.
What hedge funds will tell you is this is creative destruction in capitalism.
We got bought by this mysterious company. Nobody even knew who they were. It was called Alden Global Capital, and it was a New York hedge fund. I said, you're an investigative reporter. Why don't you dig into Alden and just write about who they are and what they're doing, because people don't know.
I work for the bad guys. Now, when did that happen? When did I start working with the bad guys?
The Denver Post has launched a revolt against its owner, New York-based hedge fund Alden Global Capital.
A guy named Chuck Plunkett just decided he'd had enough.
It's either stand up and speak up now or write your own obituary in 2 or 3 years.
It's one of the most courageous things I have ever witnessed in a 40-year career in journalism.
We know from copious research that when a community loses a newspaper, voter participation goes down, corruption goes up.
There is misinformation out there. Communities are misinformed and uninformed, and that's really dangerous.
Somebody's got to cover the story
to argue for the sanctity of facts and truth.
There are times in your life when you are thrust into a situation where are you going to stand up and risk everything, or are you going to back down?
Newspapers are not just any other business. They are the only private industry specifically named in the Bill of Rights.
History will not judge us kindly. If one day we wake up to realize we failed to protect our community's right to know, and in turn, our very democracy.
Again, the film is called Stripped for Parts: American Journalism on the Brink. There's going to be a screening tonight, Tuesday evening, 6 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum in Champaign-Urbana. If you are in town, you can see, and there'll be a Q&A with the director, Rick Goldsmith, who joined me Monday afternoon in studio. Rick, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks so much for being with us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I should also say you're also known for your Oscar-nominated 2009 documentary, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And I hope a little later in our conversation we can talk some about that. And it's ongoing, sad ongoing relevance for what's happening today. But let's start with local newspapers, because your film makes the case that this destruction of local news isn't just about technical disruption or changing reader habits, but a deliberate financial strategy. Can you just walk us through briefly the overview of how that works?
Well, the business model for newspapers started to fail at the beginning of this century. in the early 200s. And around 2006, 2007, hedge funds started to get in, private equity. And unlike traditional publishers who really had kind of two goals, one was to have a, you know, a vibrant business and make some money, hopefully. But the second and most important was to be serving the community. Really, journalism is a public good. And the best of newspaper publishers tended to be local and tended to care about their communities. The new hedge funds that came in, they really only had one purpose, and that was to make money. And Alden Global Capital was among the most visible of those hedge funds. And they snapped up newspapers beginning in about 2010 all across the country. And their MO was distressed asset investing. They found a way to find failing businesses, failing industries, sometimes even failing countries. They invested in Greek debt. And to make money out of it. And that was their genius, if you think of it from a Wall Street point of view. Unfortunately, what happened was the distressed asset investing involved a couple of main things. Well, three, really. One is because they were failing industries, you could buy them for a song. So newspapers, you could buy them very cheap. Then they would get rid of their assets, which were sometimes worth more than the entity itself. So for newsrooms, for newspapers, that tended to mean newsrooms, which were large, which were tended to be downtown, large to incorporate large staffs. And as the newspaper business model started to fail, the buildings became expendable, and Alden Global Capital said, well, let's buy the newspapers, let's sell off the buildings, and then number three, let's cut the staff. And that's typically what they did. So the first thing they would do is sell the building. The second thing they would do is trim the staff, often by 30, 40, and sometimes 50%. And there they had it. They had a new model. They made their money, and the newsrooms were severely hampered. And one more part of that was, as they reduced the staff, they tended to get rid of the most senior reporters. They would offer them buyouts, and with the senior reporters and editors walking out the door, you lost a certain amount of institutional history.
Definitely. I lived some of this myself, and we could talk a little later about it wasn't Alden, but it was a different company, Gatehouse Media, that tore apart the newspaper where I worked 15 years ago, the State Journal Register in Springfield. But what sets Alden apart from some of the other? Because it wasn't the only company doing this sort of thing. What sets them apart?
Well, I think what set them apart was a couple of things. One, they were among the most ruthless. But I think that what is important to realize is that with companies like Gatehouse and the others, the similarities were more striking than the differences. But what brought out the differences was the focus by journalists on what Alden was doing. And as you'll see in our film, Julie Reynolds, who tends to be she's the reporter who you see as a through line of the film, she worked for an Alden-owned paper. It went downhill for the reasons that I just explained. And she took a buyout, as she had to, because working conditions were so bad and the morale was so bad. And a couple of years later, she got together with the News Guild, her old comrades at the News Guild, who were she was still in touch with. And they decided to open a website of which she would be the investigative reporter, since that is what she was good at. And she would investigate Alden Global Capital. And after 2 years of investing that and showing to her audience was, you know, mostly other journalists, some of whom worked at the Denver Post, the editorial writer at the Denver Post, a guy named Chuck Plunkett, wrote about his hedge fund bosses and how terrible they were for local journalism. And one of the lines from his editorial was, if you won't support good journalism here, sell the paper to someone who will. And it became an editorial that did two things. Once it inspired demonstrations at the local newspapers, but also at the headquarters in New York City of Alden Global Capital. But it also reached the wider audience. It went viral, you could say. The New York Times wrote about it, the Washington Post, Esquire, the Huffington Post, many, many newspapers. And it became an event in the newspaper world. And as it became more known among more journalists, they began to educate the public about this new entity in newspaper ownership, the hedge fund, and how it was destroying local newspapers all across the country.
Yeah, and really taking advantage of, as you said earlier, I mean, the media business was struggling because of the end of classified advertising. And I remember those times. People were looking, who do we blame? Is it Craigslist and the guy who created that? Is it Facebook and Google for a time? And those are all real things, but they're not alone, and they were hastened in some effect by some of this work from Alden. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Rick Goldsmith, who's a documentarian. His latest film is called Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. There's going to be a screening tonight in Champaign-Urbana at the Spurlock Museum, 6 p.m. I think we should talk about the importance of the newspaper, because there's a generation of people now growing up who don't even really understand what the newspaper, the role that it played in communities once. And you have that this quote from John Oliver in the film where he says, the media is a food chain that would fall apart without local newspapers. So talk about the importance of them and how their collapse really affects our broader information ecosystem in America.
Well, if you go back to the beginning of our country, even before we were a country in the colonial days, the newspaper tended to be the center of kind of community life in any given town, city, or as the country expanded westward to the outposts in the Midwest and the mountain states. And when I say it became the center of community life, flowed into and out of the newspaper office. You found, you know, the newspapers in the old days were really run typically by one or two people. But you learned about what happened in and around your community from the newspaper, and you fed what happened in and around your community to the newspaper. As we grew up as a country through the 19th century, through the 20th century, it expanded. There were more reporters in each town. They had a business model that largely because of advertising, and advertising was supporting the newspapers, allowed the newspapers to be big and have big staffs. And so they could cover the city hall, but they could also cover high school sports. And they had an art critic and a movie critic. And it became something that was the center of families. Immigrants came to this country, and many of them didn't speak English and learned how to speak English through reading the newspaper, and learned it became part of the assimilation into American life. Up until probably the late 1900s, it was so dominant in our fabric of life that individuals learned about their communities and what was going on through the newspapers, and it became the center of debate. And all through our history, it became the center of debate. And that's how we made decisions, political decisions, by reading what was in this newspaper, offering our own opinions through the newspaper. And then you come to the beginning of the 21st century, and as the internet started to take over, that kind of what newspapers offered institutionally kind of was on the wane. And I think we're still struggling with that business model or no, we're still struggling on how to, one, keep each other informed with real news and real solid opinion that's based on facts and share that to continue to try to make democratic and political decisions in our community and have that work throughout the community. And as we look at new models, maybe younger generations have new models, we are going to eventually come up with the solutions on how to make that work. But right now, we're in a crisis where we don't have the model on how to do it. We get misinformation and disinformation from the internet, and democracy is being crippled in many different ways.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. My guest is Rick Goldsmith, a documentary filmmaker whose latest project is called Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. It's about how private equity companies are buying up newspapers, selling off their most valuable assets, and slashing the staff. The main subject of the film is Alden Global Capital, one of the biggest newspaper owners in America. Among their targets in recent years was the Chicago Tribune, which, while still an important news outlet in Illinois, has dramatically scaled back its ambitions from its peak 40 years ago.
Most newspapers don't have their own foreign correspondents. Most newspapers don't have a Washington bureau or keep as many columnists and local reporters on staff. But Chicago has always been known as a great newspaper town, and at the Tribune, we intend to keep it that way. A great city deserves a great newspaper, the Chicago Tribune.
We need to take a break. We'll have more with Rick Goldsmith when we return. Also, if you happen to be in Champaign-Urbana tonight, 6 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum, you can catch a screening of Stripped for Parts along with a Q&A with Goldsmith himself. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest is filmmaker Rick Goldsmith, director of the documentary Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. It examines how hedge funds and private equity firms are dismantling local newspapers, squeezing every dollar they can from them, regardless of the consequences for our civic life and our democracy. Rick will be presenting his film tonight at 6 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus. I spoke with Rick Monday afternoon, so we're not taking calls live today, but we did ask members of our texting group about the quality of their local news. Lloyd in Danville says, news today appears to be focused on world, national, state, and local hot-button issues of the day, driven by pundits. Local communities miss out on what's reflected and what's making their news worthy. The diversity of communities, as an example. Staying informed is a major challenge due to the inaccuracies in today's news, he says. People of color making significant contributions to communities are never adequately covered. I'm extremely concerned and disappointed. Thanks for sending that in, Lloyd. You can join our texting group by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Rick, I want to... Let's talk about some of the people behind this. Who is the grandfather of vulture capitalism?
Well, the grandfather at Alden Global Capital, I wouldn't say he's the first, but he is a prominent practicer of vulture capitalism, is a guy named Randall Smith. And he is basically a Wall Street guy, went through, Ivy League schooling, Cornell and Penn Wharton School of Music, went straight to Wall Street. And this is, in the late 60s or early 70s, and gravitated to bankruptcies. And as he did, he became a kind of an expert in what bankruptcies were about and how to influence actually the outcome of bankruptcies through all sorts of machinations. And what he discovered was there were ways to make more money easier on failing businesses than on successful businesses. What Randall Smith really perfected was a thing called distressed asset investing. And it involved, it's kind of a three-step process. One is, if it's a failing business or a failing industry, you buy that business at a song. You get it at a very, very cheap price because it's undervalued. It's maybe in bankruptcy or on the verge of bankruptcy. Then number two, you figure out what the assets are of that company. In the case of newspapers, it tended to be the downtown newsroom. And they were big to accommodate a big newsroom. Get rid of that. Sell it off. And it's prime real estate if it's downtown and if it's large. So they make their first money that way by selling off the asset. And then the third thing is you cut the staff. So it's you cut the staff, you've cut your expenses, and you can continue making money even after you've made your big chunk by selling off the assets. And they found that it works perfectly as a business model if you don't care what the product is. But what it can't do is deliver good journalism because you've stripped it of the most important thing, its staff, its newsroom staff, and the people who are delivering the news and opinion to you.
Yeah. And, you know, Randall Smith is such an interesting character, too, who's doing this sort of, again, distressed asset investing or vulture capitalism, as it's come to be known, among people who dislike it. He doesn't allow himself to be photographed. He never does interviews. His protege is this guy named Heath Freeman, who's kind of a finance guy. And similarly was very reticent. He did do at least one interview a few years ago, with, I think it was the Washington Post. Sometimes we get criticized for personalizing what are really systemic problems, but I wonder if there is something unique about the handful of people behind the handful of companies that have really done so much to destroy news in America, local news.
I think it's important to personalize the people who are behind the institutions. We tend to think, if they're not personalized, we tend to think of them as a monolith. In the beginning of the 20th century, the muckrakers, as they were called, were investigative reporters who looked at the robber barons of that day, Carnegie, Rockefeller, and it was these overstepping bounds of capitalism that were practiced by these robber barons that needed to be exposed. And by focusing on the actual people who were the most, the most visible purveyors of it, they were able to get legislation changed. They were able to make a difference in how our society and how the regulators of our society, how the public could form together and get their elected representatives to change the rules so that they were more friendly to the public, to the general public, and what we needed to move forward as a country. So I think that that focusing on the people like Randall Smith and Heath Freeman is a legitimate way to kind of not let them get away with, oh, this is systemic, or, oh, this is just capitalism, this is just late-stage capitalism and how it works. Because if we don't do that, then we can't come up with legislation, antitrust legislation, applying antitrust legislation that's already on the books, coming up with acts of Congress that will limit the free reign that hedge funds and private equity have in so many aspects of our lives.
Part of the film also looks at what people are trying to do in response to this, not just the protest, which is a big part of it, but also come up with new models for journalism. You film at the Institute for Nonprofit News Conference in 2019, and somebody there says, newspapers are not going to recover. We're building a new industry You're changing the culture so that the public supports news. And something I worry about, I've had stuck in my head since last year. There was a piece in the Financial Times in which I'm just going to read the lead of it. Some longtime listeners will have heard me read this before, but it begins, "For all the angst about polarization and disinformation, something very different is in fact going on in news consumption. The mass media age is ending. We're returning to a time when most people get almost no news." And I wonder if you see that. Do you see that as a problem? Like, it's not just that once these newspapers have gone away, people have lost the habit of following what's happening in their community. And now we're in this post-information society somehow?
I don't think we necessarily have to be in a post-information society. I think we are in the midst of a crisis where, as the newspaper model has started to fail us, we don't yet have the new model of moving forward so that we get the best of what newspapers used to offer. And still offer in many communities, which is coverage of what's happening locally, what's happening next door, whether it's a development going up or some company is polluting the streams or the water supply, or just simply what are the movies and the plays and music venues that are happening this week, and what are the high school football scores? So these new organizations, many of them are nonprofit, and they think of themselves as public service journalism, which I think is a step up from what a lot of the old legacy newspapers, which catered to the advertising world a lot more. So we do have some positive developments, and they're in the embryonic stages, let's say. There's 400 or 500 nonprofits that have, most of which have probably sprung up in the last decade or maybe two decades, in cities and towns across the country, and more are coming, are forming as we speak. The caller before who said there was kind of an absence of local news. There's not an absence of local news, but you may have to work harder to find it. What are the new organizations that maybe you never heard of in your community? In Silicon Valley, there was a big newspaper called the Mercury News, San Jose Mercury News, and it was bought by this hedge fund, Alden Global Capital. But they have the San Jose Spotlight has now been operating for about a decade. A lot of people don't know about it, but more and more people know about it every day. So you want to work, as a consumer, as somebody who wants that local news, find out what, by Googling, find out who's doing the local news in your community. It's there, but it's not as centrally located as it used to be with the newspapers.
We heard from a number of listeners who said that they're thankful for NPR. They we appreciate that, obviously, but, as local newspapers have declined, Terry in Batavia said, "Thank heavens for NPR. It keeps me connected and informed on national, state, and local news." Ann in Urbana said, "I get my news from listening to NPR," among other outlets. And one of the things that comes up in the film is this idea of public funding, right? The Corporation for Public Broadcasting provides some money to PBS and NPR and member stations. But as we have acutely felt this year, this funding is not without controversy. And I wonder if you think now, the film came out, I think, in 2023, given what's been happening just in the last few months in Washington, do you think we could ever agree on public funding for something as divisive as the news has become?
The public funding model is actually being instituted in different ways in different states. New York, I think Illinois, actually has some sort of legislation either on the books or being debated in the state house. California, New Jersey. There are Obviously, things to watch out for in terms of public funding. If it can be voted in, it can be voted out. If there's an administration that wants to get rid of it, that's maybe a warning sign that we can't make this kind of a national model, that maybe it has to be a local model. Whenever there's money involved, and there needs to be money involved in journalism, it, like anything else, it costs money. It's a public service, and we pay for things that are public services that don't make money. We pay for the police. We pay for the fire department. We pay for our public libraries, maybe some of our public hospitals. That can be applied to news organizations as well. It doesn't have to be newspapers per se. So there are models springing up everywhere. And I think what's important, what's been an important breakthrough in the last few years is public funding as part of the solution. If you would have brought up public funding as a way to get through this crisis 20 years ago, it never would have flown. But we've reached a point where most of the people in the know have figured out that the business model that we used to depend on for our daily newspaper is gone. It's gone forever. And if we're going to come up with some vibrant journalism, if we're going to rebuild and reinvigorate this important kind of lifeblood of democracy, we have to be creative, and people are being creative in every state and in many communities throughout the country.
And near the end of the film, you have a series of people making the point that there is not a market solution to what's happening in journalism. Do you think that's true? That there can be, that this is just something that has moved beyond what the markets will sustain?
I think it is, and I think that's both a bad thing and a good thing. And here's what I mean by that. I think the business model, as in there is an industry that can make money out of informing the public, as newspapers did for almost, you know, maybe a couple of hundred years, that's gone. That has just gone the way of, you know, with the internet, with all the things that people know about, it's gone. But the need for this public service that we call journalism has not gone away. And in fact, we're seeing the dangers, the consequences of its partial demise right now, where there's misinformation and disinformation that tends to be dominating the public discourse. And that's something that we, if we want our democracy to thrive and to survive and work like the founding fathers wanted it to work, we're going to have to come up with solutions that make sure it works.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is The 21st Show. We're talking with filmmaker Rick Goldsmith about his documentary Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink, which examines the causes of the crisis in local journalism and find it's not just about the collapse of advertising and changing consumer tastes, but it's also been engineered by a relatively small number of companies looking to cut and squeeze news outlets for every penny they can get. Never mind the gaping hole that leaves in our civic life. There's going to be a screening of the film presented by Rick himself at 6 p.m. tonight in Champaign, Urbana. It's at the Spurlock Museum on the University of Illinois campus. I spoke with Rick on Monday afternoon, so we're not taking calls today, but we did ask members of our texting group about this, about the local news in their communities. Katie in Springfield said, "I only listen to NPR and read the Illinois Times. Everything else is just a copy-paste from owned and paid-for propaganda machines." And Tony in Champaign said, "My wife and I are used to seeing a great hubbub in town with multiple police cars and perhaps fire trucks, and most of the time there's little, if anything, on the TV about what happened. I wish Nextdoor, the social media site, I wish Nextdoor would function as a first news medium." We're going to continue with Rick Goldsmith after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and let's get back to my conversation with filmmaker Rick Goldsmith about his documentary Strip for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink, which examines the intrusion into the journalism industry by a series of companies, notably Alden Global Capital, which are, what would you call them, distressed asset investors, politely, vulture capitalists, impolitely. There are a relatively small number of companies that have cut and squeezed news outlets for every penny they could get, never mind the hole that leaves in our civic life. I got to say, I experienced this personally. I worked for the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield. I went back and checked the website directory on the Internet Archive. In 2008, the year I was hired, there were 59 of us in the newsroom. That counts editors, reporters, photographers, a few clerks, a librarian, the editor's secretary, 59 people. And today, if you visit the State Journal Register's online staff directory, it lists 7 people. So from 59 to 7. And that was owned by Gatehouse Media, which is now Gannett. I spoke with Goldsmith in studio Monday afternoon. He's in Champaign-Urbana for a series of events at the U of I, including a screening of Strip for Parts. That's at 6 p.m. tonight, April 1st, at the Spurlock Museum. Can you put this in the, I mean, we mentioned distressed asset investing. This is part of a broader problem in America, right? You have Senator Elizabeth Warren, her legislation in the film. It was called the Stop Wall Street Looting Act. Talk about how what's happening in newspapers is not just isolated to newspapers and how that has become a problem for our economy.
Private equity and hedge funds, which are almost they're cousins, they're almost the same thing, have been taking over more and more industries and institutions in our daily life, nursing homes, doctors' practices.
Funeral homes, I think.
Funeral homes, trailer parks, all sorts of things which have the problem of two things which are kind of endemic to private equity. Private equity tends to have one goal in mind, and that is how to make money for its investors. And the actual thing that they're getting into is really secondary if it's thought of at all. So the business of journalism or the business of running a senior living center or the business of a trailer home park, they can be gutted by all sorts of kind of Wall Street tricks to the detriment of the people who benefit from the newspapers or the doctors or the, you know, senior living community.
You know, and I'll interrupt you because you mentioned trailer parks, and that's actually Alden owns trailer parks. I was looking up some of this. There are almost not quite a dozen in Illinois that it's bought in the Metro East area. Those are just the ones I found that, you know, as we talked about earlier, I happen to see a local newspaper report on. I'm sure this has happened in places where there are not as much local newspaper reporting happening to pick up on this stuff. What do you understand, to the extent we do, about why Alden, this company that has done so much to harm newspapers, is now buying up trailer parks?
Well, they're very, very good at identifying industries that can that they can make money out of because of the way it's structured financially. So with trailer parks, they can be more ruthless about who lives there, when they pay the rent. They can raise the rents there because they're not generally regulated very well. And the people who live there have really only two options, and neither of them are good. One is to move away, and that means to find another place to live, which is not easy. And the other is just to, you know, capitulate and pay the rent, because they have the new owners have the backing of the local laws to say, well, if they don't pay the rent, they're gone. So, you know, a family has a medical emergency and they live in a trailer park and they're between a rock and a hard place. So what that means in a larger sense is that all of us in dwindling numbers have actual control over the places we live and the places we work at and the decisions that need to be made. And as more and more of our lives are taken over by private equity and hedge funds, it means a loss of control in a very, very disturbing way to the very things that are precious to all of us, the way we work, the way we live, the way we commune with our neighbors. And it's just a detriment that is slowly eating away at the fabric of our social society.
I guess in the interests of fairness, we should say that Heath Freeman, one of the two people behind Eldon, he gave this interview to the Washington Post where he said, I'm paraphrasing, but he hoped that he would be seen as somebody who saved newspapers someday. It's hard to imagine how one could see that, especially because in some places these papers had little debt. The Tribune, the Chicago Tribune, is one example of a place that really didn't have debt. It was making a modest profit, and in order to buy it, when Eldon took it over, it heaped a bunch of debt on the Tribune itself, which had to be repaid to other Eldon companies at an interest rate of 13%, which I guess just goes to more of this business model that finds money in all these creative places. In the time we have remaining, maybe we can pivot to your 2009 film about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. I wonder if you see a through line between the sort of government secrecy of that era and, what we're seeing today. It's maybe secrecy is not as big a problem, although that is still a problem, but we also have this flood of information and misinformation. Do you see a through line between then and now?
I'm going to flip that question on its head. I see a through line in the reaction of Daniel Ellsberg and the one sense who was a whistleblower who uncovered a Pentagon document in the late 60s that showed how the government had been lying to us about Vietnam, and comparing him to the journalists that we focused on in my film who saw a real problem in their profession and in the communities their profession served. And they did something about it at great risk to themselves. To me, the lessons of both of them are lessons for today. As more and more of the control over our lives is stripping away because of financial institutions, hedge funds, private equity controlling more and more, there's more of a need to step out, take some risks, and bring some of that control back to the people who actually do the work, the people who are in the community affected by the decisions that we have. I think we're seeing right now with the new administration stripping the federal workforce that really adds to the quality of our lives and taking care of so many jobs that we need to have done, whether it's getting Social Security checks out to people or reaching out to other countries with the whole USAID being demolished. It's something that we all need to put our minds to, our actions to not let it happen to us. There was a famous book written in the 30s called It Can't Happen Here, kind of an ironic title to show how authoritarianism that was happening elsewhere in the world couldn't happen here. Well, it's happening, it's in front of us, and it's incumbent upon us to do something about it.
Yeah, the great Sinclair Lewis, it can't happen here. You know, Ellsberg took such extraordinary personal risks to bring what he did, the Pentagon Papers, to public light. I wonder if you see similar courage today, or do you see a lack of such courage today? I mean, I guess he was just one individual, but there were also the newspapers and their publishers who, at some personal risk, financially or otherwise, brought his reporting to light. Do you see that replicated?
I see it. I see both happening. I see both people kind of kowtowing to the impending authoritarian threat, and I also see many, many people working against that. There's a small newspaper in Vermont called the Barry Montpelier Times Argus, and they reprinted an editorial that had been first printed in 2017 when the then President Trump was talking about the press as the enemy of the people. And they just reprinted this editorial last month, and it begins like this. We are the enemy. It's true. We say that with no hesitation. If you abuse power, we are the enemy. When you use propaganda to mislead the people, you are the enemy. If a public official deliberately hides documents or closes meetings, we are the enemy. We will come after you. If you are an oppressor of the underprivileged, we will never allow anyone to silence the voices and opinions of others. And the editorial goes on in that voice. And I think it's that kind of courage and seeking out of or exposing abuse of power that is needed from the Fourth Estate, that is needed from the news media. And there are pockets of it that are happening right now, and there need to be more. It's up to us, and it's up to all of us.
Returning to Strip for Parts, which again is going to be, there will be a screening tonight at the Spurlock Museum, 6 p.m. What do you hope audiences take away from this film? What action? People are hungry for something they can do now because they feel so powerless about what's happening.
I think the first thing that people can do on a very simple level is seek out the old and new, especially new, news organizations in their community that are addressing local news and opinion. And that's easy enough to do. Once you've sought them out, support them. They generally ask for maybe subscriptions or voluntary contributions. Take that upon yourself. Nothing is free. There's no free lunch. If you want them to survive, support them. The other is on a national level, seek out those maybe not the old legacy newspapers. People like Heather Cox Richardson and The Contrarian, and The Guardian. These are just a few of organizations that are covering what's going on very, very well. And they're few and far between, but you can find them out. So take it upon yourself to do that. Support your local news guild, the union that supports newspapers all across the country. You can come to our website, and we have a whole list that's probably five times as long on our website, and that is strippedforpartsfilm.com. And you'll get more resources, more of what we're doing, and how to reach out to organizations like Rebuild Local News. Free Press is another one. Organizations that, if they want to go further, that are working on this problem, working on the crisis of local journalism, and re-envisioning and rebuilding the future.
Rick Goldsmith is the director of Strip for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. The film screens tonight, 6 p.m. at the Spurlock Museum at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We'll have details to that, as well as a link to the website he just mentioned at our website, 21stshow.org. Again, if you're not in town, you can also find this film streaming on Canopy, with a K, which many of us can access with our library cards. Rick Goldsmith, thanks so much for being with us today on The 21st Show.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, we'll begin with Congressman Brad Schneider. Then we'll talk live with Aziz Rana, a professor of constitutional law at Boston College Law School, about whether we are already in a constitutional crisis. We'd love to hear from you on that topic. If you want to email ahead of time, talk@21stshow.org is the address. Or you can join our texting group. Send the word talk to 217-803-0730. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.